My favorite word is an Irish name that translates into English as she who intoxicates. Dispensing emeralds to a worn rock breaks on me now like a riding wave, that name so redolent of mead and slaughter, whose single syllable exudes odor and salts the sands, shell-encrusted caves with arms and glinting sovereignties of water, calming tribute shores, O my newborn daughter, bloodied and aloft, warrior queen of Connacht, let me drink once more the royal name, Maeve. I don't know what you got up to under the covers in your bed when you were about 8, 9, 10 years of age. Here's my confession. The poem is called Diogenes. Whenever I have a poem, I'm not too certain if anybody's going to give it a classical name. It tends to impress certain people. When 10 o'clock lights out was called, I hitched a tent of sheets above my head and nursed a mute transistor radio, my first. Pitch black that canopy until I switched it on and lamps came up all over Europe. In that firmament, supported by my knees, I was an undercover agent of Marconi's, daring at last to edge the volume up just a little, convinced that on that random frequency, some outlandish weather forecast from another time zone was being broadcast. A yearning love song or stern national anthem, or the last report from some news bulletin tantalizingly beyond earshot. Sometimes the sounds came crisp as crystal, as when chimes of church bells carry on the wind. But often there was nothing save a hiss. And then I sped frantically through stations from spire to minaret, spinning a web of sound with my spinneret, blurring the mercury illuminated dial. It was like fleeing abandoned Babel. That receiver was a compass in binnacle to guide me over life's waves, trough and pinnacle. A lit up spirit level that kept me stable through rock or twist or swing. Radio was doom for my closed mindedness, death of taboo. While our own Levine and O'Donnell LeBoux stood sentinel on night, I broke the curfew to sleep with freedom and woke to the patter of a continental DJ and the clatter of my family from the breakfast room. We have no more of that whooping from the corner, please. This is a civilized establishment, or so Paul told me. I'm used to far less civilized establishments, or pubs in Dublin, as they're called. Next poem. It is easy. Make sure you get the Beamish in the photograph, please.
Yes, please.
I've got a local pint. On a serious note, it's easy to fall out of love with your own country, isn't it? This poem is called In Asia. I'm native here. Of course I value less those raveling skeins of turf smoke by the lakes. Grey-eyed geese heading out over the downturned mouths of rivers to sunnier and friendlier climes. So add my lost laments and bitterest rhymes to our overflowing stores of violent cradle songs, while harvesters outrasp even the corn crake. But you have not been round here quite so long. You gasp at partial rainbows, smell sweet rain, you cry to hear the curlew go unanswered late in May. Vixen tails of flame flit in the cold fireplace. And through your senses, I can almost love this ragged coasted island once again. I just want to say a word. My first time ever visiting Cork City, and I'm really impressed. I love it straight away. It just has that feel to it. Thanks to Paul for running what is a legendary night all around Ireland. I mean, I've travelled on the most antiquated train service in Europe just to get here tonight. I love the place immediately, and I love this night, I go lots of nights in town. A lot of them are a bit soulless, and this place immediately has that great atmosphere, a great poetry night needs. And yet it has a literariness that doesn't, you know, doesn't mean, literary doesn't necessarily mean obscure or not fun or inaccessible. I don't really like themed ideas in poetry, or theme bars or theme nights or whatever. But I want to talk a little bit tonight, as I'm in between poems, about inspiration as a concept and where certain ideas for certain poems came from, without taking, I hope, the heart and soul away from whatever poem it is I'm reading. I think a lot of poets have had very difficult upbringings, and that gives them inspiration and gives them material. I had a childhood that was idyllic, out in the countryside in Meath, big farm, well off, lovely parents, lovely brothers and sisters. I think about the worst thing that ever happened to me was the day they changed our telephone number from 6 digits to 7. I see some people are laughing quite insensitively, but I thought I had to write a poem about this, struck as I was, and it could only take the form of an ancient Irish lament. So here it is. I hope you, if I break down, please support me. And the poem is called 255242. Suitable 5242. A balanced phrase, synonymous with home and days of perfect length, an unencumbered sound estate. This easily remembered line of poetry, hidden in a huge tome, could spell me back from rusting, spoke-filled hallways to the oak desk and the cast iron chair. Evoke my name for old friends anywhere. Its incantation was auspicious, always. 255242. But even as the apparatus slumbered, the bands were read, robotically intoned by electronic clerics of the telephone, announcing that its single days were numbered. Soon it must stand, preceded by an 8. I took it badly, I admit. How strange that loss is often preferable to change, that love's less blind than unrequited hate. 8. 25, 52, 42. My palindrome, my beautiful caesura, and the dactyl swallowing anapus, all of its poetry ceased to exist with the lumbering arrival of that extra and primordial figure. As when you met your childhood sweetheart with her new fiancé, and her voice had that syncopated rhythm. Engaged, she said. Do ring. But now you can't get through on 255242 without that fucking cipher in the way. And yet, you're still reluctant to leave it. Some people take their landline numbers with them when they move house. I can well believe it. Thank you very much. You're genuinely a lovely audience. The next poem, I'll read it if that's okay, because I've only just finished it recently, and it's from my mother. It's called Halcyon Days. I don't know if you know the Greek myth where the gods allowed kingfishers 2 weeks either side of the winter solstice. Like, I think it's like the 14th to the 28th of December. And they allowed balmy weather at that time so the kingfishers could nest. And the poem's called Halcyon Days. Unseasonably warm from New Year's Eve until Epiphany, weak sun revived and handsoming the tills in sodden fields where red-winged missile thrush and field fare graze beneath the low and huddled clouds. And yet, no hint of storm-force winds to come. Such crouched, conspiratorial northeasterlies as fling the hooded crow round darkening skies. And that is how it was the day she died. Her mildness and her brilliant wit restored for those few hours. So clear, so temperate, she must have sensed what midnight held in store, but hugged that secret to herself so close I left and did not look back as I left. Thank you very much. The age profile of the audience here is far younger than that which I'm used. I say that everywhere I go. I did have the terrifying experience. I'm a school teacher. I teach secondary school. I teach English in Des Moines, County Meath. And I had the terrifying experience. I agreed to do a poetry thing in Swords, County Dublin. And I walked in and there was about 100 18-year-olds there expecting, I don't know what they're expecting. I'm used to playing in front of 100-year-olds. It was the most terrifying experience. But I say this because I don't know if you as an audience are old enough to have experienced this next feeling, the kick in the chest you get when you're walking down the city street and out of the blue, there is the face of someone you once were very close to, but whom you haven't met in a long, long time. And you realize that you're still crazy after all these years. I saw in the middle-aged stranger's face the fine-drawn, darling features of a girl I'd loved in college. Full lips, arched brow, brown eyes that mirrored my straining and my squinting incredulity as we waltzed our way, as if on casters, towards one another. It hardly struck me that she'd changed that much, though she must have. Time had crumpled and folded back onto itself like a yellow scarf for the few minutes that we ranged and squabbled over and rearranged, the autumn lived together and the decades spent apart. "You've got a memory like a sieve," she said. Later, I wondered if this looming mug had shocked her in its grizzled, garbled state, or if it still retained some of that boyishness from days when our affections had full gallop and shied at the first high gate of commitment. But since I'm not the sort to spend my nights undergoing by windows the metallic and meticulous surgery of moonshine, or want to sift through memories of hair, tawny and winnowed by an evening breeze and the cornfield loving light of September, to curious mates, I just laughed the whole thing off. "Evidently she'd no regrets," I said. "She was far too happy to see me." "What about you?" they asked. "Regrets? Regrets are what the French discuss over baguettes and filtered coffees and unfiltered cigarettes." Thank you very much. I have an awful habit of pointing out, once I've finished the poem, pointing out all the little tricks in it. I'm very much, I don't know if the word is literary, but I'm very much a traditional poet in that way. All the stuff, I just think traditional poetry works as well in a situation like this as performance poetry or slam poetry. So I will tell a little bit about that poem, in that it has about 12 or 15 different references to things being sifted or winnowed or divided out or separated. So I suppose in the end, it's as much about the lies we tell ourselves and others about our past and so on. I've got about four left, if that's okay. Are we okay for time? Thank you very much. This next poem, I'm trusting that I won't get the reaction tonight that I got the first time I did this poem in Dublin, to a very urban audience. The poem is called "A Cattle Grid." Now, does everybody know what a cattle grid is?
Yes, yeah.
About bloody time. I mean, we had one at the entrance to our farm in Meath. It's such a genius idea. It must have been some Scandinavian. who came up with it. So smart. Instead of having to, when I was a kid, my job was always to run ahead of the cattle and close all the gates in the farms so our cattle wouldn't run in and destroy the place. And then eventually some bloke came up with this idea of a cattle grid that used the psychology of cattle. If you ever dealt with cattle, there ain't much psychology going on there. Use the psychology of, they're terrified to step onto narrow spaces. They've got such narrow legs. And anyway. Enough on the ergonomics of the cattle grid. I'm going to read the poem. The cattle grid. After the raids by driven sheep and cattle on his lawn, the neighbour dug a neat pit at the entrance to his property. "That'll keep him out," he said, and he bricked the edge and laid an old five-barred gate flat on it, yards from his cottage. "Don't do things by halves." The neighbour never did. That summer, hedgehogs fell and rotted in his dark cage, calves broke legs and children crashed their bikes in it. Neighbours of his in that close-knit village speculated and pondered on the grid and what lay under or between its staves, but he just stood at dusk, right foot on the bottom bar, arms folded, looking down with pride on the rolling acreage of his kingdom. A trophy. Only when the negative was developed and the photograph framed, of the boy proudly holding aloft his pockmarked and spock-eared perpetual trophy, did a visitor pick out, there and tiny in the curved plate silver above the freshly engraved name and date on the cup's pedestal, the grotesquely distended reflection of the father at the camera. I mean, I do say this everywhere I go, you're the best audience ever. I have to say, you are the greatest audience I have ever. I'm not joking, jeez. You're, sometimes, I'm guessing a lot of you are writers and readers here, whatever. Sometimes, or you attend different events. Sometimes when you go to events, if people haven't been to a poetry event before, they kind of don't know what to do. They don't laugh at my joke. Maybe my jokes are enough, I don't know. They don't laugh at my jokes. They don't cry at the weepies. They just don't do anything. They don't know what to do, and they're looking for other people to give them a cue. Other places you go, and half the people there have heard what I've read before, and others haven't. This is a very special thing for me, to come to a place where I've never met any of you before, where none of you, probably maybe apart from Paul watching a film, has ever heard my stuff before. It's very, very, it's just great. And you're a great audience. As Paul said, they're an audience who can listen. See what I mean? Hear that? But that silence sometimes is terrifying. If that silence is too respectful, it's not, but your silences are commendatory and supportive. I love it. Yay. This is where an arsehole says, "Give yourselves a round of applause." I don't know my timing, so I think I've got enough time for this last one. It's about 28 minutes long. No, it's quite a long poem, and I suppose it's about 3 minutes. And for me, other people think it's okay. For me, it's really my favorite in many ways. It just sounds like I'm talking about my childhood and what it was like where my parents had a pub from when I was 4 to about 12 in rural County Meath in the 1970s. Holy God. And yet, what have I got into it? When I was talking about inspiration and all that earlier, a lot of people go to beauty spots for inspiration. They go to mountainsides or lakes or valleys or abroad. I find, if I can say something quotable, beauty spots give me inspiration. They never give me fucking poems. You know what I'm saying? Let me find that. or they give me poems just the same as everybody else would write in that place. I mean, one of my pieces, you might find it online, I mean, where did the inspiration come from? I was in the Jacks. I was in the downstairs toilet in the Palace Bar in Fleet Street. And I looked upwards, as you do, and I got a poem out of it. The cattle grid. Something as ordinary as that. That's not advice, I'm talking about myself. But the inspiration from this, I'm not always confident what I'm doing, but I was confident that I knew what it was like to be a kid of parents who had a pub in the Ireland of the 70s. In the Ireland of the 70s, which after yesterday's election results, I think we're going to return to pretty shortly. real cork reaction there. Okay, so this poem, it should sound like just a sweep through my childhood, but really, as I was writing it, it started, not I, but the poem, started channeling works that I read all through my life. Bible, Old and New Testament, Coleridge poems came in there, Graham Greene's Third Man, Ibsen, another picaresque, Ibsen's Peer Gynt, another picaresque works. Proust, of course, Shakespeare, Tolstoy, Turgenev. Nearly everything I read ended up influencing it, and I hope you enjoy it. It's, the title will show what I thought about working in a pub, being in a pub as a kid, and how inappropriate that kind of was. The poem's called Behind Bars. I really want to thank you again. I'm not bullshitting you about how fabulous and unique this venue is, and how great you are as an audience. And God, thanks a million. Behind Bars. They say that Ireland's small town publicans of the late 1970s were either teetotal holy or staunch alcoholics. It's hard to shake the Barnaby shambolic and trolley dry gin sales rep who would mither us mad in his cups. Part-time Republicans banging tight fists on counters a la Khrushchev for Harp, Double Diamond, Carling Black Label, light-hearted lager so full of flavour. Grieg and Elgar mornings, Last Orders Babel, and humble hop-fed shadows mulling over some wild goose chase chicanery or mischief from impish, fulsome, balderdash compadres. Not forgetting that scurf Franciscan priest from Rhodesian missions who vomited such graceless bachelor bile to graffitied chrome and tile confessional ladies' toilets. We knew we'd have to leave behind the slop trays, carpet stains, oak wood and linden from Colditz, and scores of hand grenade half pint jugs fetched from crew but left besmeared in woodlouse revelling cellars which stored guilt too. We turfed Alf Devlin out footless nightly to that same dark head stretch where Gint died after we'd sold it to concentrate on crush and pen and farm, brushing from our souls the sawdust from sealed bags dropped outside the butcher's by the sawmill, washing our hands of a lime tree's stuck gum. Strange that I should summon each scene less Wild West carnival than pioneer ordeal, more Britvic bitter lemon lime dash crush than cordial, and hum twanged tunes only for songs of exile to Liverpool, America or Brum, from whence we'd all returned in pilgrim zeal, hoping for the quiet man getting the field, I sneer. Yet this is just the version formed, fixed, grafted here for clear eyes and ears, fixed as English closing time, fixed as the marvelled altars from which we served, their form and diction of gulps, drafts down of hearsay, memories, fiction, to meet poetic justice out, or garbled truths pound bootlessly windows after hours, or push too hard on swing doors into grey smoke, yellowed mirrors, sketched hunters, glass opaque, fake casks, quotations unimproved by lack of context. Back there last month, seafood platter, craft beers. Lock-in session for emigrating colleagues. I'm partial to a stout or two myself. I spotted oblong puddles on the shelf beneath those upturned spirit bottle optics and took stock roughly of my childhood years. Wouldn't you love to own it now? You asked. I began. Don't you know what they say?